Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
All right, two future neurologists, two current neurologists. It's going to be a neuro love fest. Vanessa, would you like to give us the chief concern?
Okay, here we go. So this is a patient who is a 64-year-old female with no significant medical history, and she had a complaint of shallow breathing for a few minutes duration.
Shallow breathing. Just to confirm, it's neurology morning report, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, no heart failure, COPD, well, luckily Sridhara is double boarded, so he'll be able to save us. Okay, Maria, shortness of breath in the neurology clinic. So we're going to presume that other medical specialists have looked at this patient and said, not us. Let's see if neurology can figure it out. What would you think about here?
Yeah, well, this is interesting because immediately, like thinking fast, nothing brings neurology, right? So first heart, first lungs, because I know there's other organs out there. So those two things first. But then I think putting that into the Venn diagram of neurology, I would definitely start thinking about more neuromuscular disorders. So thinking that shallow breathing may be just like fatigue, and then thinking of all like the neuromuscular disorders that could cause that sort of fatigue, but also maybe something more centrally located. So maybe somebody's like encephalopathic and then they have like altered breathing patterns. But I think those are the two things that I'm thinking. Nothing concrete for now.
Okay. So wondering if this could be neuromuscular weakness leading to shortness of breath. Do you want to go down that path a little further? What types of conditions could give weakness that would lead to shortness of breath?
Yeah, well, thinking about how we classify like the nervous system. So I'm definitely thinking more on the peripheral nervous system. And then sometimes I think I go centrally to peripherally, but in this case, I'd go like peripherally to centrally. So thinking things muscle wise. So, you know, for example, you know, Duchenne myopathies, things like that, you know, just because of the muscle atrophy, they have weakness, but also thinking about like neuromuscular patterns. For example, the two main things that I think about are like myasthenia gravis and Lambert-Eaton. I don't usually associate them with having, you know, weakness in like thoracic muscles, but maybe like botulism is something in the neuromuscular junction that I can associate with more thoracic weakness, let's say, and having these disturbed patterns of breathing, and then nerves. And then I can definitely see a lot of like polyneuropathies causing altered breathing. And that's something that we always need to be concerned about when we see people, for example, with Guillain-Barré syndrome or CIDP, checking their respiratory conditions. So I think those are like the three main buckets that I think when I think of, you know, weakness or fatigue causing altered breathing patterns. Thank you for helping me like reason more through it.
I didn't do anything. You did everything all on your own. That's perfect. Yeah. So we'll have to flesh out, obviously, in the history, what is meant by shallow breathing. And I think Vanessa said it was transient. So that'll be something to think about also. But yeah, I agree. On first pass, when you hear shortness of breath, you ask, as I asked Vanessa, are you sure you're looking for neurology, respiratory, pulmonology is down the hall, cardiology is down the hall. Are you sure you're in the right place? And if people have said, no, we haven't found anything, maybe you can help us out. Is this a neurologic cause of breathing difficulty? Then what would be the neurologic reason? It would most likely be something related to weakness of the respiratory muscles, diaphragm, et cetera, as Maria said. And right, it would be very rare to get shortness of breath from a central cause. You can get central apnea, but that's not really what this is. You can very rarely from medullary lesions get something called Ondine's curse. I forget what the myth of Ondine is and why it comes from that. It's named for that Greek mythology, but where people actually stop breathing, but I don't think they describe shortness of breath. I think they just stop breathing. And I'm not sure if it's more during sleep or not, actually. But otherwise, I agree with you. I'd be thinking about the periphery. And so working backward as you did, very severe muscle disease can cause shortness of breath. It would be pretty atypical, I guess, for a patient with a myopathy to present with shortness of breath, just because they probably have weakness elsewhere. And that's usually sort of pretty advanced by the time you get to the respiratory muscles. But there are so many myopathies and it's hard to keep track of all of them. And so it's possible that there may be one or two that could present this way that I'm not aware of. And then working backwards, neuromuscular junction, you mentioned the three diseases that can occur there: myasthenia, Lambert-Eaton, myasthenic syndrome, and botulism. Lambert-Eaton, I've actually never seen. I'm on the lookout for, but it must be extremely rare because I've been doing this for over 10 years now and haven't ever seen a case. And I've asked around and I haven't found too many people who've seen one. So I think they usually present actually with sort of proximal weakness. They don't present in as typical a sort of neuromuscular junction way as you would expect. They can have some autonomic dysfunction also. And then botulism, I've also never seen, but usually those patients are very sick. It's sort of almost a Guillain-Barré mimic with a very acute polyneuropathy, usually descending with a lot of cranial nerve involvement. The pupils are classically involved, though not always. And that can be a distinguishing factor from Guillain-Barré, where you really shouldn't see pupil involvement, but you can see involvement of the eye muscles. But usually a lot of eye, a lot of bulbar, and then extremity weakness. And like Guillain-Barré, also they'll have no sensory because it's neuromuscular junction. But I think, again, if they had shortness of breath, there'd probably be a lot of other stuff going on with it. And then myasthenia gravis, as you said, would probably be the most common of those three, something we see with some frequency. And those patients, again, almost always, I don't know the exact numbers, present with eye movement abnormalities, whether ptosis or diplopia, and would be probably less likely to present primarily with shortness of breath and not have anything to go along with it. Though maybe the patient does have ptosis and eye movement things, and we just haven't heard about them yet, or they're not that salient to the patient. And maybe this was some type of fatigable respiratory weakness. But again, to have that in isolation might be a little bit tricky, and then, or a little bit atypical. And then you mentioned going backwards, so further to the motor nerves. Of course, patients with Guillain-Barré can develop shortness of breath from respiratory muscle weakness, though, again, usually there's a lot more going on, and that's sort of the nadir of their condition. And then sticking with the motor nerves, patients with ALS, again, can develop shortness of breath from respiratory muscle weakness. Usually they have other elements, by which I mean other regions of weakness. It'd be pretty atypical, I think, to present just with shortness of breath. Although I did have one patient, one of the first patients I saw in the outpatient setting, who came asking if he had ALS and had a lot of fasciculations, but it had an EMG that showed what's called benign fasciculation syndrome. And he didn't really have any weakness except a little weakness in an ulnar distribution. And I thought, he looks too good to have ALS. He just has these little mild areas of weakness. And I said, I don't think you have ALS, but I'll follow you. But it looks like you maybe have ulnar neuropathy, had a little pinky weakness. That was it. And then I was going to repeat the EMG. And then he called me and said, I'm really short of breath when I lie down. And we did an echo and we did other things and there was nothing. And finally he got the repeat EMG with my colleague because the benign fasciculations one had been outside and it did look like ALS. So he had very mild hand weakness at the beginning, but developed some shortness of breath relatively early on. But I haven't seen that too often. So mostly I'm just repeating what you said, Maria, and adding a few sort of more things from practice over years, which of these things theoretically could cause shortness of breath and which ones practically in what stage of the illness you might see it. So not entirely sure. Anything else on your mind, Sridhara?
No, that's a pretty comprehensive list. And like both of you said, neuromuscular always comes to mind just because it's so much more common as a cause of first time like respiratory failure or patient being unable to wean from the vent in the ICU rather than central causes without any other symptoms. Like usually you anticipate like a lot of other coexisting findings or history for central causes. So first thinking fast, you're thinking neuromuscular at this point.
Yeah, I agree. And anything either of you would do with the fact, I think Vanessa said it was just one transient episode. Is that right? Or multiple transient episodes?
Well, it's been going for some time, like just a few minutes, a straight few minutes having that shortness of breath.
It's only happening for a few minutes. So before we hear more about that, does that make you think of anything, Maria or Sridhara? Episodic?
I just want to clarify, Vanessa, like, is it episodic and it's been going on for like acutely or has it been going on? Well, I guess you're going to tell us about it in the history.
Oh, good questions. Go ahead and ask. Yeah, as if you were asking the history, Maria, go ahead.
So it's been happening acutely and persistent.
I think if it's happening acutely, as you've mentioned and Sridhara has mentioned, most of the neuromuscular disorders that we were thinking about or like myopathic diseases and peripheral nerve disorders, I tend to think about them more in like the chronic or at least subacute category I'm really interested in getting to know more about the history and seeing like if there's anything that happened.
Yeah. Does that do anything for you, Sridhar, make you think of anything, the fact that these are episodic?
I will say this. I've seen epilepsy do all sorts of weird things where patients come in. They're like, I have episodes of shortness of breath where I cannot catch my breath and they're hyperventilating. And, you know, could this be a manifestation? Like, are there any symptoms before or after the shortness of breath? Makes us think, could this be epilepsy or something like that? That's one thing that does come to mind. It's a little unusual, but...
Great thought. Yeah, it's a little hard to know what to do with episodic shallow breathing, but sometimes when we're stumped on a symptom or we hear the patient's history and it's hard to sort of figure out what to make of it, I like to think of and advise my residents to do. Sometimes I say, just round to the nearest thing. So if you just say, well, I don't know what to do with episodic shortness of breath, but I know what to do with episodic neurologic symptoms, right? Then we would be thinking, is it TIA, seizure, migraine? Well, migraine, episodic shortness of breath, that's a real stretch, right? No. TIA, no. Well, I won't go down my rabbit hole of saying how infrequent I think real, true TIAs actually are based on modern definitions of those. And then seizure, you do pause for a second and say, well, seizures really can do anything. And one thing they can do is cause some autonomic dysfunction. Patients can be tachycardic or bradycardic during or after a seizure, or have sweating or rising gastric sensations. Could they have episodic shortness of breath, or could they be having an episodic arrhythmia that's causing shortness of breath, and that arrhythmia being caused by epileptic activity? My mentor, one of the great neurologists of our time who passed away a few months ago, Marty Samuels, was very interested in the overlap of cardiology and neurology and talked about the carduncleus, the area of the brain where the heart is represented in the insula. And I could never remember it, although he taught us many times. One side, I think, when triggered, causes tachycardia, and the other side, bradycardia, right and left. And then when they're refractory in the postictal stage, they can go away. Or sometimes the patient comes and says, this really doesn't fit with anything. I don't think it's a neurologic condition. And I'm going to tell the patient, I don't think this is a neurologic cause of your symptom of tingling, numbness, weakness, because your exam is normal. These tests are normal. So it might be some other type of condition, but not neurologic. This is also my check for myself. Like, if this was something, like it's episodic tingling here, what nerve or root would it? No. Okay. Just making sure, you know, it doesn't. I rounded to the nearest and I couldn't make it work. But yeah, episodic anything, right? If we stop getting distracted by shortness of breath, we might wonder, could these be epileptic in some way? To cause just rapid, shallow breathing briefly and it could be a seizure. I guess it could be some kind of autonomic.
You bring up insula, because insular seizures cause a sensation that your throat is closing, like laryngeal constriction. So many patients describe this. So they feel like they cannot breathe.
Seizures can do anything, right? There's ictal spitting and ictal laughing and ictal crying. There's post-ictal nose wiping. There's all sorts of, there's musicogenic epilepsy where either music triggers it or people hear music. There's a million types of things that can happen depending on the areas of the brain and the subjective sensations. There's deja vu where you feel like you've already been in a place before. There's jamais vu where you feel like you've never been in a place. There's all these different things that can happen. So probably if this is really episodic, brief, maybe we do move away from a neuromuscular disorder and towards seizure. Okay, this has been fun so far. This is a very provocative, interesting chief concern for us, Vanessa. So if you don't mind giving us the rest of the history, we'll see how that helps us.
So here is what you've been waiting for. So this patient initially had neck pain. So 7 hours prior to the consult, the patient was coming in from her garden when she suddenly had persistent right-sided pressing neck pain that was moderate in intensity. It was associated with nausea, diaphoresis, dizziness, and she consulted via Teleneuro, which advised her to be sent to a hospital. In the interim, she denied losing consciousness, but she was seen sitting on a chair with her head back, unable to speak and move her extremities. EMS was called, and she was immediately brought in. In the hospital, 3 hours prior to consult, after all the necessary diagnostics were done, she was treated and no other intervention was done. The patient was admitted to the neuro ICU for close monitoring. In the interim, she was doing fine until a few minutes prior to consult, she developed shallow breathing, which was associated with left gaze preference, and she couldn't move any of her extremities, and she became incoherent and less responsive.
Okay, there's a lot there. Let's make sure we have it all. So she was doing fine, and then suddenly develops neck pain, sweating, and then comes to the hospital and can't move anything. Is that what happened?
Before she came to the hospital, they said that she was already unable to speak and move her extremities. Upon arriving at the hospital, this spontaneously resolved, leaving just left facial droop while seen in the ED. After that, she was treated then, and she was admitted for observation. But a few hours later, she was doing fine until she suddenly had shallow breathing and left gaze preference and couldn't move any of her extremities.
Got it. And so these episodes of shallow breathing, she'd been having them before coming into the hospital also, or this was the first one? And then
this was the first one after she was in the hospital.
I see. Okay. A lot going on there, Maria. Not too long from now, you might find yourself in an emergency room seeing a patient like this with all sorts of things happening. And what would you be thinking?
Well, let's see. I think I might have missed something, but let's go like each part at a time, and then I'll try to see if I can figure out how to integrate everything. The right neck pain is interesting because I think we always makes us think about dissection of like vertebral or like carotid arteries. It's interesting because we don't hear any like trauma or manipulation, but just having a neck pain makes me wonder if this is ischemic in nature. And going back to how we were thinking about episodic or sudden neuro symptoms, and definitely thinking about TIA/strokes with the neck pain makes me really worried this is vascular. And then that with the losing of consciousness that we tend to think about also, you know, what can make us lose consciousness in like the neuro aspect. And I think the two big ones are for me are stroke and what we've been talking about, seizures. But because of her age, because of the neck pain, I think I would prioritize something vascular. With the left gaze preference, this becomes really useful sometimes to help differentiate both seizures from vasculars, because we tend to think of, you know, irritative lesions such as seizures, you know, pushing away the gaze preference, in ablative lesions such as strokes, like pulling in the gaze preference. So I think the gaze preference made me also wonder if it's one of those two. And the paralysis, it could either be, you know, some sort of, again, you know, vascular component causing like a stroke and causing this weakness, or it can be like a postictal state. But then also the shallow breathing, which makes me really worried that maybe this is just like localizing to the brainstem, and then our seizure or our stroke can be there. So that was a lot of rambling. Let's see if I can try to put it into like what I'm thinking more cohesively. I'm definitely worried she has something in the brainstem that can be like dangerous for her life, just because we do have like all of like the autonomic and like cardiovascular control, respiratory control there. And the two main causes that I'm thinking that are involving the brainstem is either vascular or seizure. And I think I would prioritize vascular first because of the neck pain makes me worried about some sort of dissection.
Yeah, brilliant. So we have emergency neurology, right? So again, there's a lot of complicated stuff happening, but as Maria brilliantly said, basically if it's sudden neurology, it's either stroke, seizure, trauma, or some type of toxic metabolic thing. And this is pretty focal. So less likely toxic metabolic. Some toxic metabolic things can cause some focal things, but we won't get into that right now. We don't hear about trauma. And so we're sort of left with stroke or seizure. And then we have pain, not usually a part of seizure, although I'm sure maybe Sridhara knows some type of seizure that can cause pain because they can do anything. But sure sounds like a neck pain and neurology. It's hard not to think of neck pain and acute neurology, hard not to think of a dissection, carotid or vertebral, that then led to a stroke. We don't know yet all sort of the focal symptoms that were here. We just heard the patient couldn't really move anything. And then we heard there was some left-sided facial weakness, but then some left gaze deviation. So maybe we'll have to wait a little bit more before trying to put all that together for a little more information. But yeah, I agree with you. I think we're in the stroke and or seizure category. The only thing I'll mention is you thought we could be in the brainstem, which we could be. And we also thought about seizure. Can the brainstem cause seizures, Maria?
That's a good question. And I don't know the answer, but I know because there's very little white matter there. And no, I don't know. I don't know. Let me think about it. But I'd say, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Your intuition of no is correct. Yeah. Seizures come from the cerebral cortex. So you'd have to have some type of lesion affecting the cortex in principle to cause seizure, or some type of abnormality. I won't say necessarily lesion because it could be electrical. But yeah, you can't, as far as we know, generate seizures from the brainstem or cerebellum. So could all of this be stroke? Maybe the patient has a huge stroke and is developing elevated intracranial pressure from, for example, a territorial MCA stroke or a territorial cerebellar stroke. And because of the intracranial pressure, they're having changes in their breathing, part of a Cushing response. Or maybe they've been unlucky enough to have an infarction in the brainstem in areas that we mentioned earlier when we were first thinking about the differential diagnosis of neurology and shortness of breath, and is having had some damage to respiratory areas. So I think, yeah, we're in the sudden neurology, so stroke versus seizure, unless the gardening, there was some toxin there of some sort, but not sure how that would cause pain and such a focal presentation. And then we didn't hear about trauma. What are you thinking, Sridhara?
So yeah, I mean, all good points. And what came to mind was a vert dissection. The one thing I'll add is the vert also gives rise to the anterior spinal artery. So you can have an infarction of the brainstem and the spinal cord. And if you infarct the anterior part of your spinal cord, you're going to be weak on both sides. And you can also have respiratory issues because, you know, you're affecting the anterior horn cells that supply the diaphragm. So that is also something that would be high on my differential in someone like this. And, you know, this is what is going to kill her. So absolutely high on my list is a vert dissection and plus minus an occlusion of the basilar artery, which is something we can treat, especially if they're in the window for thrombectomy or lytics. One thing about basilar artery occlusion is these patients can present with seizure-like spells, where every time there's a stimulus given because they're ventilated or something, they can have arching of the back, opisthotonus, and they look like seizures and they can be mistaken for status. So it's very important not to miss that in someone who has no history of seizures and suddenly comes in like this. You want to make sure you're not anchoring to a diagnosis of seizures. And the gaze deviation, I mean, Maria is absolutely right. If you're dealing with gaze deviation towards the side of weakness, you're dealing with seizures, but you could also be dealing with a brainstem stroke because of the pontine area getting affected. And it's helpful if the gaze deviation is away from the hemiparesis, then you're thinking more MCA strokes.
Yeah, fantastic. Lots of different possibilities and lots of great points, Sridhara and Maria. Right. So one possibility here, we don't really know what the pattern of weakness is yet. I think Vanessa is skillfully withholding information from us since some treatment happened, some findings were seen so that we can keep our discussion interesting before getting too much information too fast. Although in real life, probably before neurology was even at the bedside, this patient was getting a CT and a CT angiogram. But it's fun to do it this way, since sometimes that might not be able to happen quickly. Or as Sridhara said, people might have such a high pretest probability for one thing that you could miss something else even as you're looking at the scan. Yeah, so one possibility would be this patient had some large anterior circulation stroke, for example, of the MCA, and that's causing... So if you had a left MCA stroke, you would have gaze deviation to what side, Maria? Sorry, I decided to turn that into a question midstream. What direction would the eyes be if you had a large left MCA stroke? Would they be pointing toward the stroke or towards the right-sided weakness?
So I just said it, but now I found that it's phrased as a question. Let me think about it. So I feel they're both like constantly like activated, and then they pull, like they, that's what keeps your gaze like centered. And so if you have like a lesion that's like ablative, so like, for example, a stroke that you're not activating, the other one is going to activate it and it's going to like push the gaze towards the lesion. And then, for example, in like the opposite, that seizure, then you have like your constantly activated frontal eye field, but then the other one's like super activated. And that's Wait, I just forgot what the lesion is, but the other one's going to be super activated. And so it's going to push away from the lesion. The seizure, I feel pushed away, and stroke, I feel pushed towards. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. And that's brilliant. Yeah. So if you get the left frontal eye field, for example, from a left MCA stroke, and it's ablative, then the right frontal eye field wins and the gaze deviates to the left. And if you have seizures arising from the left frontal eye field, they push the eyes to the opposite side because the eye field is hyperactive, as Maria said, and pushes the eyes towards the contralateral field. Another way to remember this or think about it, since Maria gave the very neurologist, neuroscientific, tonic activation, disinhibition explanation, is just like the left brain controls the right side of the body, sees the right visual field, et cetera. It makes sense that the left side of the brain would send the eyes to the right to look over in its chosen field. And similarly, the right side of the brain sends the eyes over to the left. So if you have a hyperactive lesion on the left, those eyes will do more of what they're supposed to do, which is go all the way to the right. And if you knock out the left, for example, from an MCA stroke, then the eyes will deviate toward that side because there's no activation to the opposite side. That's for a hemispheric stroke. So if a patient has a left MCA stroke, they're weak on the right and have a left gaze deviation. If they have a right MCA stroke, they're weak on the left and have a right gaze deviation. But as Sridhara said, next level, that's iFields 101. iFields 202 is that if you have a brainstem lesion, the brainstem horizontal eye fields send the eyes to the ipsilateral side. So the left paramedian pontine reticular formation, or PPRF, sends the eyes to the left. Right PPRF sends the eyes to the right. So if you have a left-sided pontine lesion, you're still above the crossing of the corticospinal tract. So you get right-sided weakness, but you would get right-sided gaze deviation because your left PPRF doesn't work. So you can't look to the left. So your eyes go to the right. I've probably only seen this once or twice. Sridhara, have you seen this with some frequency? It's pretty uncommon in my experience.
Once a year.
All right. Well, you're a stroke neurologist, so you have an enriched population. But I haven't, as a neurohospitalist and seeing a lot of stroke, I feel like it's a pattern we talk about a lot theoretically, but much less common than MCA strokes, which are super common. Is that fair?
And eye movement 303, thalamic hemorrhages cause a complete opposite side gaze deviation. So
yeah,
we're going to ignore that.
C. Miller Fisher described wrong way eyes with thalamic hemorrhage. And I used to say wrong way eyes for the brainstem. And one of my mentors who studied with Miller Fisher said, no, that's not what he described, because a brainstem lesion, they are going the right way with respect to what the brainstem would do. And that for some reason with thalamic hemorrhage, they can go the wrong way. I have actually never seen that. Have you seen it, Sridhara? You have. Okay. I've read about it. I have not seen that. And it's not even clear to me in the paper that we understand why that happens, but a left thalamic hemorrhage causing a right gaze deviation for whatever reason. I don't know why. So that's 303. And the other part of 303 would be that if you have a seizure from the left hemisphere, as Maria said, you get right-sided gaze deviation. But when you have the postictal phase and that area is then refractory, you get deviation back to the refractory seizure focus. So if a patient has a focal seizure from the left and they have right-sided shaking and right-sided head and gaze deviation, then postictally they'll have a right-sided Todd's paralysis and left-sided gaze deviation can look like they're having a stroke. So always in the differential for a stroke is, you know, an unwitnessed seizure and you're seeing the patient in a postictal state. We've still been hiding from this respiratory element here. So another possibility, as Sridhara said, is what if this is all brainstem and the patient has had a basilar thrombosis, which, as he said, can cause so many different patterns and can be missed. Patients can present sort of with a syncope-like episode, presumably from occluding the vascular supply to areas of the reticular activating system or bilateral thalami so that the patient loses consciousness. At onset, they can have sort of posturing that can look like seizure-like movements. They can have acute agitation and delirium, presumably, again, from just getting elements of the reticular activating system. And of course, if it's a full basilar thrombosis, you can even end up locked in, although that is fortunately quite uncommon. And so one could imagine here if the patient's pain maybe is from a vertebral artery dissection and unfortunately threw a thrombus up to the basilar and then has this sort of acute onset of full paralysis and then maybe get some flow past it or spontaneously recanalizes, or maybe the treatments Vanessa alluded to were some thrombolysis or thrombectomy of that basilar, but not in time to save some tissue or all the tissue there, and there's some infarction, though maybe the patient is having some respiratory complications of medullary infarction. Okay. Those are our thoughts. I'm guessing, Vanessa, before anyone had even time to discuss all these things, this patient was in the CT scanner getting a CT-CTA. Up to you if you want to tell us what sort of happened there and what you alluded to, or if you planned to tell us the exam and everything in more of the traditional order, that's fine too.
Let's do the exam first. So in the exam, her vital signs, she had a pulse rate of 68, a respiratory rate of 38, a blood pressure of 76 over 49, and an O2 saturation of 80%. And her temperature was at 97.9 degrees. So on general exam, she had normal sinus rhythm. She had equal chest expansion. Lung sounds are there bilaterally. Trachea is midline. The respiratory pattern is even and unlabored. Her abdomen is soft, non-distended. Pulses, 2 plus radial, no ecchymosis or hematoma. And on neuro exam, she's alert, able to nod yes and no appropriately, will attempt to mouth words, will follow simple commands from neck up. Pupils are 3 millimeters bilaterally equal, round, reactive to light. Full extraocular muscles, no gross facial asymmetry, absent gag and absent cough reflex. All extremities, 0/5, and she is able to feel just light touch. For the CT head and the CTA.
Oh, well, hold on 1 second. Yeah, sorry. Okay. So just to make sure we've got all this. So she's awake and alert and moving her eyes and face and everything, but is paralyzed below the neck completely?
Mm-hmm. She is.
And is intubated in that case, I presume? Or
yes, she is intubated.
She can feel light touch, you said, but not.
Yes.
Do you mean to say not pain and not vibration, or just that was all that was tested and she
could? That was all that was tested.
Light touch was tested and she could feel that. Okay, Maria, what's going on here?
Yeah, well, I think vitals are very important because, as you mentioned, you're worrying about like a Cushing's triad and that may be causing like the respiratory distress. There isn't like any hypertension or like, so I am not like extremely worried that she's going to herniate right in front of her eyes, but definitely because of the story causing like the neck pain and this pattern of, you know, like complete paralysis below the neck, all of the cranial nerves seem to be okay. So I think definitely focusing on stroke, and because of the presentation, focusing on like basilar artery. Yeah, those are my thoughts. And it's going to be interesting to see the imaging.
That's fantastic. What got you to the basilar artery, Maria?
I think the presentation that we mentioned before, that, you know, she can't move anything below the neck. So it doesn't seem to be like the usual patterns that I have in my head of like MCA or ACA, which are more lower extremities or upper extremities predominant, and those tend to affect the face as well. So for example, for an MCA stroke, which is what I most commonly see, I'm always focusing on, you know, the pattern of weakness in the body, but I'm definitely trying to see some pattern of weakness in the face as well. And I don't see that here because of it's bilaterally, it would also be very difficult to have like hemispheric strokes that are bilaterally, because then we would need at least 2 different strokes. So focusing more on arteries that can cause, you know, widespread weakness in both sides and not affect the face. Then I think about the basilar artery. And I think because she has the eye movements, but she can't really speak. I don't know if that's like aphasia or dysarthria. I think it's hard for me to differentiate, but that's why I'm thinking about that artery specifically. And, you know, yeah, it looks like locked-in syndrome, which is, you know, no movement below the neck and just having the extraocular movements preserved.
Yeah, excellent. Right. So yeah, as you said, usually the most common strokes in my experience, Sridhar as a stroke person, he can tell me if he agrees, are probably MCA, PCA, and PICA, and then lacunar sort of non-named arteries. Not in that, I would say not in that order, but probably MCA and lacunar strokes being most common, and then PCA and PICA in close second. And then fortunately, basilar thrombosis, AICA, medial medullary, those are all pretty rare. That's my experience. Does that resonate with your experience, Sridhara?
MCA gets like majority of the blood flow. So any clot, any stenosis, everything happens there. And then you have the lacunars from traditional vascular risk factors. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, ACA, very rare. AICA, very rare. SCA, very rare. Right. As you said, Maria, MCA, you'd be expecting unilateral symptoms. Here we have bilateral. And then if you had bilateral MCA, you'd be not only very unfortunate, but there's no way you'd be awake, right? Because you'd be having bihemispheric dysfunction. And as you mentioned, the eyes seem to be doing their thing. So as we work our way down, the midbrain is okay. The face seems to be able to do what it's supposed to do. So that would be the pons is where cranial nerve 7 nucleus fascicle nerve comes out. And then we have this absent cough and gag. So we're now in the 9-10 medulla area and then paralyzed below. So we'd have to be medulla or below. We've all sort of anchored on stroke given the acuity here, but acute quadriplegia, let's say we hadn't checked the cough and gag yet. Acute quadriplegia, would you normally be thinking of stroke, neck pain and acute quadriplegia?
No, definitely. Thank you for pointing out like the gag and cough reflex. Like I don't tend to check for gag reflex because I know there's a big percentage of people who don't present that, but let's assume they had it before. And then so definitely there are aspects above the neck that make me worried that this is also localizing above the neck, right? So they have cranial nerve 9 and 10. Because if they only had like quadriplegia, I'd definitely be thinking of like stroke, but like medullary strokes or some sort of trauma to like the spinal cord, not really, you know, brain stems or brain.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you heard acute neck pain and quadriplegia, you'd be wondering about some spinal catastrophe. It's pretty rare to get a big disc rupture up that high. Just the spine is most mobile. It's sort of C6, 7, T1, and then down at L4 or 5, S1. So to get a C3 disc or something, be pretty rare. Or vertebral collapse. Maybe this patient is older, maybe has undiagnosed cancer, and there was a vertebral collapse. And I guess if it was high enough, you could pinch the medulla as well. And so I think that's possible. I had a colleague, I think they wrote it up, and it's one of the most devastating spine MRIs you'll ever see. It was, I think, a patient with rheumatoid arthritis presented with acute coma and paralysis, and everyone was working them up from stroke and looking at the CTA, looking at the vasculature. And then somebody noticed that there was complete atlantoaxial dislocation, and the patient had essentially, if you look on the scan, and I'm pretty sure they publish it, it's pretty striking. The head is just kind of completely disconnected from the neck. And that is why the patient was comatose and paralyzed. So yeah, basilar thrombosis, or as Sridhara says, probably if it's the medulla, right, the vertebrals in basilar form, the vertebrals join to form the basilar at about the pontomedullary junction. So as Sridhara said earlier, maybe this is not the basilar, but the acute, the anterior spinal artery, and we're getting the lower medulla here. So we're getting the corticospinal tracts, and we're getting nucleus ambiguus for cranial nerve 9 and 10 is a little more dorsolateral, but something in that kind of vertebro-basilar junction there to get the anterior spinal arteries, which come off actually of the vertebral arteries going inward and downward to then supply the cord. So I guess that's where we'd be, right? Is this an acute stroke? I think we've moved away now pretty far from seizure, or was there some neck trauma here, or was that pain not trauma, but some structural collapse up in the high cervical? What happened next, Vanessa?
So here are the scans. So the CT head showed no intracerebral hemorrhage. And in the CTA brain and neck, there was an age indeterminate occlusion of the distal V3, V4 segment of the right vertebral artery. Otherwise, unremarkable CTA of the brain and neck.
Okay. Sridhara, you want to tell us what you'd be thinking as a stroke neurologist here? You saw this syndrome. Maybe you can talk us through in real life. We're getting to the localization because we're doing this as an academic exercise. I'm sure you'd be thinking of all these things, but what would be happening in real life as this patient rolled in and got this CT and CTA with this exam?
Definitely, if the patient's within window for lytics, we would have given her thrombolytics. That's number one. And then, you know, one other thing we would do is we would talk to the interventionalist, because the V3, V4 segment, although it might not be causing the anterior spinal artery occlusion, you want to know if there is an anterior spinal artery occlusion above. And that would be something we would strongly consider in a case like this patient who's locked in to see if they would be a thrombectomy candidate. Sometimes IV lytics might not be able to dissolve a clot, but intra-arterial lytics can also be considered in such cases because this is a devastating injury. The person's, you know, quadriplegic.
Yeah, great thoughts. All right, if there was high enough suspicion for stroke in the window, no contraindications, which there were not on the CT, and we haven't heard any past medical history, medications or otherwise, that would put the patient at risk for lytics, probably they would get them. Fair number of patients who end up not having a stroke get thrombolytics, and a sort of risk that we accept. It's pretty unlikely to have a catastrophic brain hemorrhage from thrombolytics if there's no stroke to bleed into. It's even rare in patients with stroke. That's why we give these treatments. It's, I think, 6% in the literature. Is that right, Sridhar? But it's much lower in modern practice, actual TPA-associated hemorrhage, brain hemorrhage. Is that right?
Yeah, around 3% more with right. Get with the guidelines. Yeah,
perfect. So patients certainly would have gotten that. And a lot of the intervention, thrombectomy interventions, are in the anterior circulation because you can get right up the carotid into the MCA. A basilar thrombosis would also, people go after it, but the data is not entirely clear. But I think most people, given the devastating injury, would try to go after a basilar clot. Here we're not seeing a clot. There's a vertebral occlusion, which is not uncommon in patients with chronic vascular risk factors, though we haven't heard of those here. This could be a dissection as the other possibility. But you have two vertebral arteries, so to get this devastating injury from one acute or chronic occlusion of a vert would be relatively uncommon. Often you see these vert disease, even incidentally, patients with strokes elsewhere or other pathology. But yeah, we'd certainly, if the patient was in window, offered to the, given the deficits here, as Sridhar said, ask our interventional radiology colleagues, do you think there's anything you could go after here? And if it was just a chronic occlusion, I'm going to guess they would say no, but let's see what happened next.
Okay, so when she was in the ED, she was given tenecteplase. She came in the window, given tenecteplase, but since she presented with an NIH stroke scale of 2, no other interventions was done, and she was sent for in the neuro ICU for observation. I also have here her MRI brain and MRI cervical spine. So in the MRI brain, acute infarctions in the posterior circulation was found and notable for involvement of the cervicomedullary junction and upper spinal cord. The MRI cervical spine shows an abnormal edema within the inferior aspect of the partially imaged right cerebellar hemisphere, as well as within the right ventral cervicomedullary junction and ventral upper cervical spinal cord extending to the mid aspect of the C2 vertebral body at the site of infarcts noted on recent brain MRI.
All right. Does this represent any particular vascular territory to you, Maria?
In posterior circulation, well, now I kind of have like a hint because I know it's right vertebral artery. So I'm just trying to specifically find things of like arterial spinal artery, but I don't think we have like an MRI of like the spine. And then I'm trying to look for things in like the posterior inferior cerebellar artery, which I guess it's the cerebral hemisphere and the medullary junction. I think that can all be explained by PICA, which comes from the right vertebral artery. Oh, there's the spine. And then I'd be looking for things in like the anterior spinal artery as well, I guess. I don't know if that answers your question.
That answers the question. Yeah. So to get the medial, ventral, brainstem, and spinal cord at the level of the medulla, and at the level of the spinal cord would be anterior spinal artery, as Maria said, which comes from the vertebral arteries. But that does not supply anything dorsolateral, including the cerebellum. So it's not fully explained there. So you'd have to invoke, it's the inferior cerebellum. So the pica, which, good for you, Maria, comes off the vertebral arteries. So the PCAs come off the top of the basilar, SCAs just below that for the midbrain, AICAs for the pons, and then PICAs off the vertebral arteries rather than the basilar in most patients for the posterior lateral medulla and then the inferior cerebellum. We didn't hear the side for the cerebellum. Was it unilateral, Vanessa, or bilateral in the cerebellum?
In the cerebellum, it's bilateral.
It's bilateral. What do you do with that, Maria?
Yeah, I've been trying to like wrap around the idea that we have the occlusion of the right vertebral artery. So I was thinking about, you know, the pica, which can, you know, I know it can cause like contralateral and ipsilateral findings, but just unilateral. And then I think the anterior spinal artery, because the spinal cord is like smaller, could actually cause like bilateral findings, but that would only explain what we see in like the spinal cord. I'm not really sure how to explain a right vertebral artery causing contralateral cerebellar stroke. Okay. And I'm just thinking about like, maybe they have a weird anatomical different vasculature that can explain this, or we need to go back and look more closely into like the left arteries.
Yeah, brilliant. Right. So the vertebral arteries is interesting. Once you get into the pons, into the midbrain, into the PCA territories, you could have gotten something from either the left or right vert, that once it's in the basilar, could go left or right. But if you're in the vert and you have pica on the other side, there's no way to explain that, right? Because it wouldn't go up and then back down, and that wouldn't make sense. Unless because of this full occlusion that there's some retrograde filling, and then things get really complicated vascular-wise. But yeah, when you see bilateral infarcts, supratentorially or infratentorially, it does raise the question of whether you have a more central source. And as I mentioned, these vert occlusions are not uncommon and not always necessarily the cause, just because you see them. So one would wonder actually if that's an incidental finding and there was some larger clot from the heart or otherwise that went up and then sprayed into both vertebral arteries. What are you thinking here, Sridhara?
So the most common cause of disease, a pica stroke, is vert disease. So you can explain the ipsilateral pica stroke. Some people have both picas coming off the same vert. So you can have bilateral pica strokes. And like you mentioned, cardioembolism. The other reason you can see bilateral pica is pica happens on one side, and then there is swelling, and then that compresses the opposite pica artery. And so you develop a smaller stroke on the opposite side. Usually we see this in patients with raised ICPs and with like a pica stroke that's obstructing the fourth ventricle, but it doesn't happen immediately on presentation. So if you see it on presentation, either cardioembolic or a vascular anomaly where both picas are coming off a vert is higher on the list.
Interesting. I did not know about the one side swelling and then pinching off the other.
Yeah. So you see like a little wedge-shaped infarct on the other pica.
Interesting. Okay. So we've made the diagnosis. This patient had posterior circulation strokes, presumably the breathing, but Vanessa will teach us, has something to do with the fact that the medulla is involved. But then we would want to figure out why the cause of the stroke. And so even if you see that vertebral artery there, as we've said, you can't, that vertebral occlusion there, that can't explain the bilateral inferior posterior circulation stroke. So we'd want to take a good look at the heart with an echocardiogram and Holter monitoring. And in the meantime, have the patient on some secondary prevention. If they're really healthy and have no vascular risk factors, maybe they just have no known vascular risk factors, then we'd also think about, you know, this patient is 64. I would consider them medically young, and you might do your sort of stroke in the young or stroke in the patient with no risk factors extended workup, looking for a hypercoagulable state, antiphospholipid antibodies, cancer, rare genetic causes of hypercoagulability, though most of them, factor V Leiden, protein CS deficiency, et cetera, cause venous side thrombosis. So you would need a PFO for them to actually cause a stroke. So if the patient, we usually don't look for those unless the patient has a PFO, but antiphospholipid antibodies can cause both arterial and venous side strokes. So you would think of sending those. And if you really found nothing, probably even think about a transesophageal echo, which can sometimes pick up small PFOs that were not discovered on TTE, although then the relevance of those is not always entirely clear, or some type of cardiac lesion like a fibroelastoma or something like that that was not identified on the TTE. What did you find, Vanessa? Did you figure out the cause of this patient's stroke?
Yes. Do you want the vinyl diagnosis?
Let me, before that, anything else you would send in this patient, Sridhara, with presumably central source of embolism and no known vascular risk factors?
TTT would be my first stop, and then okay. AFib monitoring.
Yeah. Still most common is probably atrial fibrillation, right? So the two-week Holter doesn't show it. The four-week Holter doesn't show it. These are the patients you might think about an implantable monitor to see if you catch AFib, although I'm curious your thoughts. I guess we're already in negative time left, but your thoughts, Sridhar, on this emerging literature that, you know, these sort of small burden AFib you find 6 months after the stroke, 3 seconds of AFib, whether it's really relevant to the cause of stroke or, but it's still our practice if we catch AFib and the patient's had a stroke, that we are anticoagulating them. Okay, so what did you find, Vanessa? You got some pictures of the heart probably in various ways, a hypercoagulable workup. Did you figure out why this patient had a stroke?
Right. So before I review the diagnosis, so just a quick on the coagulation, on the TTE results and the others, all were unremarkable. She didn't have any conditions to begin with. Nothing was found on the TTE. Nothing abnormal, really. The diagnosis was an acute ischemic stroke in the right cerebellum, right thalamus, left cerebellum, medulla, and anterior spinal cord. That's probably secondary to a right vertebral artery thrombus and also a likely spinal shock syndrome.
Interesting. So this would be a case where we would not know why this patient ended up with. And there wasn't thought to be a vertebral artery dissection, Vanessa? It was thought to be...
There wasn't anything seen.
And then no risk. We talked about the sort of exotic stroke workup, but her A1C, blood pressure, cholesterol, all that stuff was okay.
Everything was okay.
Okay. Yeah. So this is someone who would get the mega workup for cause of stroke. Often we don't find the answer. We sometimes call these patients having had ESUS, embolic stroke of undetermined source. And there's a couple of trials now with the new anti, not so new anymore, the 10A and antithrombin inhibitors, rivaroxaban, dabigatran, and apixaban. Being so much safer than warfarin, which was the anticoagulant available for atrial fibrillation when I was a resident, and so many complications of hemorrhages when the INR is too high, or the strokes when the INR is too low. And now we have these great drugs, and people thought, what if we just do these trials comparing these DOACs with aspirin and these patients with embolic stroke of undetermined source, presuming that they must have AFib, and we just didn't find it. And so far, trial after trial, they're showing no benefit actually of anticoagulation over aspirin in these patients, raising the question, one, of either there's some other source that is not AFib, or two, whether even these patients with these very rare and small burden AFib that we're not finding actually would benefit from anticoagulation or not. So, Vanessa, do we know the follow-up, if this patient improved, or is this an active case?
Yes, sure. So this patient was in ventilatory support for so long, for around 2 months. But eventually, she was weaned off support. She was able to breathe on her own, and she was able to gain back her motor strength. And I guess on follow-up, she was seen, okay, full motor movements, no problems in breathing, and she was really doing fine.
That's a great recovery. It's great to hear that follow-up, and that the patient, despite so ill early on and so had such a high burden of disability from the stroke, did so well. Here, Maria, future neurologist, and Sridhar, seasoned neurologist, got very quickly to spinal cord infarct on the data alone, which was very impressive. So thanks for bringing this case. Thank you, everyone. See you next time.
That's a wrap, folks.